With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hello and welcome back to the EPL Roundtable. I'm your host, Kevin DeVries, and as always, if you'd like to reach us to the podcast, you can do so by either tweeting us at EPL Roundtable or emailing us at EPLRoundtable@gmail.com. All right, we are here talking about all things Premier League, and by we, it's just me and Jamie, who you can find at Jamie Smith Sport, partially because there was kind of a big football match going on today with England, obviously, in the Women's Euros Finals, a match in which they came out champions. So Jamie, I guess we got to start off with that. It, whatever that specifically refers to, came home.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the whole football's coming home thing, which the main reason I like it so much is that it seems to really annoy a lot of Europeans. So the fact that it did finally come home is incredible. I went to a couple of the games throughout the tournament, not the England games, unfortunately, but a couple of the others. It's been great to have a home tournament, a proper home tournament, after last summer was sort of all over Europe and then England had some of the games. So it's been fantastic. It really feels like a big sort of landmark moment for women's football and women's sport in this country, probably comparable to when the US won the World Cup on home soil in, what was it, 99? I think women's football has been behind in Europe compared to America for a long, long time, but hopefully that's now going to change. I think it's easy for us to forget, and a lot of listeners might not realise, but for 50 years in this country, women's football was essentially banned. Women weren't allowed to play on FA grounds, FA stadiums. So they were essentially banned from playing. It's only relatively recently that they've been allowed to play again, and the game's now becoming professionalised. So this is all really the culmination of that. And to leave myself out of it, I'm just really happy for everyone who's spent years and years promoting and pushing the women's game to get to this point where England can go one step further and win a major tournament, the first that we've won in men's or women's football since 1966, after a few near misses at Euros and World Cups before. So, yeah, a great time, and I think we were deserved champions, easily the best team in the tournament.
Yeah, that was going to be my next question, is what did you make of the tournament on the whole? Apparently you got to make it to some of the matches, which is pretty awesome. And what was the atmosphere like in the country throughout the tournament and then coming into and then ultimately in the final? Because obviously on Twitter, everybody's like delighted, but I just was wondering if that was kind of matched by the general public.
Yeah, I think it is. I think there is a lot of enthusiasm. There's obviously still the sort of naysayers who get grumpy about women's sport and think that women should be back in the kitchen making the men's tea, and I don't think you're ever going to get rid of that, but the TV audiences have been really high. There's been sort of millions of people watching games on TV. A lot of the games have been breaking records for attendances. Wembley was sold out today. I think the biggest women's match attendance since that World Cup final that I mentioned before at the Rose Bowl, where there's 100,000 people or something. The two games I went to at Sheffield's Bramall Lane actually set a record for, let me get this right because it sounded a bit convoluted, but it's still impressive. Non-host nation group game records. So obviously home nation games tend to do really well in terms of attendances, but they were getting nearly 30,000 people going to watch Netherlands v Sweden or Netherlands v Switzerland. So a lot of people travel to England as well, which is great because obviously travel's opening up again. And it's felt like a really special occasion. The atmosphere at women's games, I don't know if you've been to women's games yourself, Kev, but it's completely different to men's games. There's so many more families there, young kids.
Yeah.
It's much more of like a party mood. You don't get the sort of aggro between different sets of fans. Everyone just seems to be there to have a really good time. It's really good atmosphere, actually. And having had a bit of a taste of it this summer, I'll hopefully get some more women's football in the future. I'm certainly considering myself more of a fan now.
Yeah, the women's game is great, and we used to cover the Women's World Cup, and we'd have like Kieran Tavamon, who I think now works for England, not the country, and the women's side of it and stuff like that. So yeah, huge advocates when we get to talk about it on the show, and very cool that England got to have that moment. And yeah, I was just looking it up, and some people reporting that it's the highest attendance for any Euros final ever, men's or women's, which if true, very, very cool. For that to happen, and very happy for, you know, all the English fans that listen to the show, and obviously all the guests to come on as well. Pretty exciting times, and it was a pretty good match itself. The start of the second half looked a little dicey with Germany kind of running riot. Were you starting to get nervous there, or were you always a little confident after that first goal went in?
Yeah, I mean, Germany as a team have got such an incredible record in this tournament. I think they're 8-9 times champions. They'd beaten us in the final the last time we got to the final, only time we've been to the final. I think that was the end of the 90s. So this is a team with a historic record in finals. But the way England have performed all the way through the tournament, there was a lot of confidence that they were going to get the job done. And I think having the home advantage with that massive crowd maybe gave them the edge as well. I think the game itself was a classic sort of major final, really, wasn't it? It was really tight. I had a feeling it was going to be a mistake that settled it. It turned out it was more just like a bit of a scramble from a set piece, which is maybe fitting with the way that the last sort of half an hour went. It was a shame that Germany's best striker got injured in the warm-up and had to pull out. I think it would have been maybe more of a spectacle if they'd have had Alex Pop up front against Beth Mead, going for the golden boot as well, all that extra subtext. But I think this England team have just got more steel about them. I know it's not the done thing to always compare to the men's team, but obviously the men's team got to the final at Wembley last summer, so it's quite natural to compare. But that England team, the England men's team just played with fear, and this England women's team just have no fear. The complete conviction. And that, I think, comes from the coach, Serena Wiegman, who was in charge of Netherlands when they won their home tournament 5 years ago now. That just seems to have made a massive difference in the mentality. All the girls seem to be having a huge amount of fun, not feeling the pressure and the weight of expectations. So, yeah, I'm really happy that they managed to get the job done. And like I said before, hopefully it's a real landmark for women in this country playing sport, and all the girls and boys will be inspired by seeing this and want to go and play football and be more active, and hopefully it'll really help to develop the game in this country.
Yeah, I saw a couple of tweets about like looking forward to seeing all the kids on the playground trying to replicate that chipped goal.
The chipped goal from Ella Toombs, obviously unbelievable. Earlier in the tournament, we've had the back heel from Russo in the semi-finals. Absolutely fantastic goals. Anyone who's still a doubter about the quality in the women's game, honestly, watch the goal from Ella Toon if you haven't seen it in the final. Unbelievable pass from Kira Walsh, sort of 50, 60 yard through ball in the air. Ella Toon goes through and lobs the goalkeeper. It's a fantastic goal. Match anything you'll see in the men's game this season, honestly.
Totally. And like the ice in the veins needed to try to pull that off in that moment. Just absolutely unreal stuff. Definitely agree. For those that haven't seen it, go watch the goal. For those that haven't seen it, maybe just go watch the whole final. It was a terrific one. And again, congrats to England at large. This match probably mattered a bit more than the one we're about to talk about as we shift towards the men's game, which was the Community Shield. Liverpool ended up 3-1 winners. And I was just curious because, Jamie, I'm sure you know, some clubs kind of count it if they win another trophy. And they're like, oh, we won a double, the Community Shield and an FA Cup. Or if they win, I think it was United that had the Europa League and something else, and I think they tried to include it as part of a treble. I was just curious what you make of the Community Shield and whether you kind of view it as like the launching point for the following season or if it's really just the end of the preseason.
I think it can be a bit of both, and I think it is down to really the teams and the managers involved, sort of how seriously they want to take it. I think Jose Mourinho was always one who treats it very seriously, wasn't he? And he's very much like, it's a cup, it's silverware, it's a title, it's something for my personal CV. not all managers seem to think the same way. I think Jurgen Klopp won it for the first time, didn't he, this year? Liverpool lost in the previous finals. I think that's right. So some managers obviously take it more seriously than others. I think what was interesting about yesterday's game, and I'm sure we'll come on to this in more detail, was that both teams are obviously adapting to the new striker. I think that's going to be the big sort of deciding factor in probably who wins the league title, whether City adapt to Haaland better than Liverpool can adapt to Nunez coming in to replace Mane. And on the game's evidence, it looks like Liverpool are ahead in terms of their adaptation period to that. But yeah, it is essentially a friendly. I think in other countries, maybe they've tried different things to jazz it up or make it more of a contest. I saw a bit of the German version that was on, I think, Saturday night as well. And Bayern seemed to treat that as a real trophy. But I don't know if other teams are particularly bothered. You'd think they would be, since they don't get a chance to win any other trophies in Germany. But I think in Italy they've moved it to Saudi Arabia and stuff. So yeah, I don't think anyone treats it as like a really, really serious trophy. But I think it is a useful thing to have. It doesn't necessarily mean anything, though, does it? Remember Manchester United win it when David Moyes came in, and they thought that was going to be the start of the glorious new era, and it turned out to be one of the only matches they won under his leadership. So yeah, it doesn't necessarily mean anything as much as us writers and pundits and commentators might try and draw meaning out of what is essentially a training ground exercise.
That's fair, but if you would permit me, what did you learn from what was essentially a training ground
exercise?
You mentioned the striker thing, and I do think that's it's an interesting note, because I don't know if Haaland has really hit the ground running as much as people expected. Had a couple of chances that people probably would have thought he would have scored. Everybody was clowning Darwin Nunez after his very first friendly, but then he's kind of been scoring in buckets ever since. Do you think that's really the main thing, like you said?
Yeah, I think so. I think overall preseason, you can get carried away in both directions. I made quite a conscious effort this season to not really pay any attention to the preseason of my team, Burnley, just because I didn't feel like it was going to be at all relevant. I think it does depend on what's going on in the club and what players are coming in. If there's a new manager and stuff, then maybe you can learn more from what happens in preseason. But just training ground games basically for fitness and working on tactical systems and getting used to what the manager wants and stuff. So I don't think the result necessarily means anything. But I think Liverpool did seem more cohesive than City. Nunez seems a more natural fit, I think it's fair to say, than Haaland to City. Not to say he's going to be more of a hit there or that Liverpool will win the league as a result, just that there's going to be more work needed from City and Haaland to get used to each other, whereas Nunez seems very much like he's going to be the same as Luis Diaz, who came in January and just slotted in straight away. He seems to have the right desire and attitude and mentality to play for that Liverpool team. Not to say Haaland doesn't at City, I just think it's going to be more of an uneven sort of fit for them.
Mostly just because they kind of played pseudo-strikerless for the last two seasons, and now all of a sudden they have that kind of focal point.
Exactly, yeah. There was a few times, weren't there? In the first half in particular, Haaland was running in behind, which is how he scores so many of his goals, because he's so fast and his movement and timing is exceptional. And City, since Aguero lost his pace, haven't had someone who did that. So they've just got used to picking the lock. And there was a few times when Haaland was making these runs and already started to look a bit frustrated because the ball wasn't coming. But I think City will get used to that and they will play that pass more, and Haaland will maybe learn when he needs to link the play and when he needs to make the runs. I think there will be a development of City style, because you don't spend all that money on Haaland, arguably the best number nine in the world, if you're not going to tailor your game to suit him. I think he'll score goals there whether they do or not. But I think it is inevitable that City are going to play slightly differently, whereas I think Liverpool are going to be much the same, just maybe Nunez will play instead of Mane in the front three that we got used to watching. what was interesting with Haaland was the chances that he missed, because in England we've obviously seen his highlight reels and we've seen him in the Champions League, and he just seemed like he never missed. So to see Haaland missing really good chances and the one at the end is an absolute sitter. That was unusual. But I think he's still going to be a huge success. He's an unbelievable talent. City are arguably the best team in the world. So it's difficult to say that it's not going to work, but it did look a bit like Lukaku at Chelsea last season, didn't it? With like the big striker who wants a certain sort of service and the team just not giving it him. I think they'll probably work it out better than Lukaku and Tuchel at Chelsea, but it might take a bit of time.
Yeah, I could totally see that happening. Although, you know, it seems pretty rude to invoke Lukaku when talking about Haaland just because of how poorly that obviously went last season. And then obviously he's already gone, already back to Inter. But yeah, I agree with you. I think the talent's too good, but they will have to rework the way that they were building attacks to get the most out of Haaland, which you'd think they would want to, given the price tag.
Yeah, right. I mean, the point of that signing as well, sorry to interrupt, it's... Yeah. City can win the games in the Premier League. That's never going to be a problem because they'll have all the ball, they'll create the chances, they'll score the goals. The whole point of signing Haaland is for the Champions League, right? They need someone who's going to make the difference in those games against elite teams where they can't just steamroll the teams and win 3-0 at a canter. They're going to need Haaland to deliver in those games. So ultimately, it doesn't really matter how he plays in August, in September, in October in the Premier League, as long as by February, March, in April in the Champions League, as long as it's working by then. That's why they've signed him, to try and get that Champions League before Guardiola leaves.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. That seemed pseudo prediction-y, so let's just do some of those now. Like I said, a lot of people not available today, so we've opted for a man that supports Championship Club coming and doing yep. Premier League predictions. But obviously, you're a pretty well-informed guy. So we figured we'd go through this. This is obviously the last preseason show before the first kickoff takes place in the Premier League. So we'll start off with who you think is going to win the league.
Well, I'm going to really stick my neck out and say it's probably going to be between City and Liverpool.
Ooh, don't make crazy.
I think those two teams have just been so far ahead of the chasing pack for a few years now, isn't it, really? Obviously, United finished second a few years ago, but it's mainly been those two battling it out. Like I said earlier, I think it's going to come down to which team incorporates the new striker better. Been positive signs for Nunez so far, but I rate Haaland so highly. I just think it's inevitable that he's going to score a bucket full of goals in that City team, and they'll work out how to play to his strengths, and it won't be immediate, but it just will work. I think City's strength in depth is just insane. They seem to have done clever business in the transfer window so far and moving on some fringe players. Calvin Phillips is a good sort of depth piece to add cover for Rodri, a bit of an alternative in there as well. They don't seem to have any real weaknesses. Left-backs may be been the problem position for them, but if they can get Cucurella from Brighton, which seems to be something they're trying to do, that would probably fix that. It'll probably come down to the matches between the two teams, won't it? And I think City have just shown in the last few years that they're slightly better. They're going for, what is it, 5 titles in 6 years. So I think it's really, really hard to look beyond City, but I wouldn't be surprised if it was really close again and maybe between 3 points at max between those two.
Yeah, obviously as a Spurs fan, I'm really hoping both of them come back to the pack a little bit. And they both may, as both of them go through those kinds of transitionary periods. Liverpool post Mane and City now with what do they call those? Strikers. actually two, because Julian Alvarez came, obviously, who scored yesterday. But yeah, I've gone with City as well. It just seems really rude that a club that was already the best in England last season suddenly gets to add a world-class striker and, you know, upgrade on Fernandinho with Calvin Phillips. Fernandinho, obviously, legend at the club, but was getting older, wasn't yep. as usable. And then you just bring in one of the better options in there for England and within England. So, yeah, pretty good signings there. I think the only interesting thing is you mentioned the depth there, and they have let a lot of their depth go. With Sterling gone, Jesus gone, Zinchenko gone, if they don't manage to get Cucurella, and it seems like Brighton are taking the same position that Tottenham did last year, and when you're dealing with a club like City, why wouldn't you? Of just being like, this is the price. Why are you still calling us? Send a check for that amount or don't. And so it is odd that they've done that 2 years in a row, but at the same time, when they didn't get Kane last year, I was like, that just cost them the title. And then to your point, won it anyway.
Exactly,
didn't matter at all. And I feel similarly about this. If they got Cucurella in, I think it would like make them air quotes clear favorites, but they might already be the favorites. So is it really worth 50 million for them to just kind of retain that status? But yeah, a bit odd from them. But I agree with you. I think Haaland's too good. I think Pep's too good. The surrounding, you know, squad is too good to not, you know, the floor for City is second, right? And then probably the ceiling is going to be first for them this year. It sounds like both of us have Liverpool in this next group, but who all do you think will finish in the top four?
Yeah, I think Liverpool second to City is a really obvious prediction to make, so I can't really be too sexy with that one. I do think Spurs have got a really good chance of being third this year. Antonio Conte is one of the smartest coaches around. Obviously, he had his little tantrum at times last season.
Thanks to you.
After Spurs lost at Burnley. Yeah, just thought I'd drop that one in there. I remember that one because it was one of the only games that we won last year. So I definitely remember that one. But yeah, rate Conte extremely highly. He's obviously been there, done it everywhere where he's been. Not sure Spurs are ready to compete for the title just yet. Although Conte will be demanding that because he is extremely demanding of his players. I think Spurs made really big strides last season. The fact Kane seems happy and settled there now rather than trying to manoeuvre himself away. It was interesting that the Bayern Munich sort of flirtation doesn't seem to have had any impact on him whatsoever. Whereas it seemed like quite a clear tactic from their point, to see if there was any interest, see if they could sort of leverage that, even though a lot of people would assume that Sadio Mane was their replacement for Robert Lewandowski. They seem to still have that sort of flutter at Kane. Obviously, Kane and Son, two of the best around. I think defensively, you can maybe still ask a question. I know Spurs fans rate Romero really highly. And it seems like Conte's got the players that he wants, doesn't it? So Spurs really backed him in the transfer market. I think they had to, because if Conte doesn't get the players that he wants, Conte doesn't stay around. So I think Spurs have done really good business. People like Perisic, very experienced, obviously what Conte wants. So I think Spurs are a good bet for third. Fourth is probably going to be a bit tighter. I often think it comes down to who's got the best manager in those situations. Chelsea are probably going to be in transition with all the changes there with the ownership, and they've lost some key defenders, Rudiger and Christensen going. But Koulibaly is an excellent signing from Napoli. I think Raheem Sterling's going to be a huge success there. So I think I've essentially gone with what the bookmakers are saying for the top four, but I can certainly see Spurs third, Chelsea fourth, which means Arsenal missing out again.
Yeah, was going to do a bold take section on last week's episode that we just didn't end up having time for. And mine was going to be that Chelsea are going to miss the top four. And then the night before we recorded the show was when they lost again in America. And then Tuchel went on his rant. And I was like, oh, maybe this isn't such a hot take anymore. Maybe this is kind of the way people are leaning. And I do think there are a lot of questions at Chelsea. We don't need to dive into it too much again, because again, it was kind of the lead for last week's show. But I think they could really struggle. New ownership, getting rid of Lukaku. Werner seems to want out the door. I don't know if you can really get through a whole season with Havertz up front, unless you are just trying to mimic what City have done the past few seasons, which could work. Infinite wingers, obviously. Ziyech sounded like he wanted to go. As far as I know, he's still there. You still have Christian Pulisic in there. Obviously, you sign Raheem Sterling. You lose three senior center backs. Although, I guess not. I think Azpilicueta actually just played their most recent match after it seemed like he was certainly off to Barcelona earlier in the window. But you do lose, obviously, Rudiger. You lose Christensen. People's opinions might vary on how much of a blow that second one is. But yeah, just feels like an odd year going in for Chelsea. And I agree with you. I do tend to go manager, but loathe though I am to admit it, that the young core that Arsenal have is really good and might be able to overcome the, like, I don't want to batter Arteta too much, But amongst the other managers that are in that top tier in the Premier League, he's definitely a little short there. But the amount of young, exciting talent that they have that can all grow together, I think could counteract that a bit. Yeah.
And they've signed really well. Arsenal have signed really well. I think Jesus and Zinchenko, obviously, they weren't regulars at City, but certainly good enough to be really key players for Arsenal. I'm particularly interested to see how Zinchenko does there, because it sounds like they're going to use him in midfield, which is where he plays for Ukraine.
Yeah.
One of the reasons he wanted to leave City was so that he could play in his best position. So I think Zinchenko's got a great chance of being a really good, important signing for them, an area of the pitch where they've struggled for the last few years. And I've always really liked Gabriel Jesus. I think he's one of the best strikers around. It's just he hasn't got the regular game time.
Mm. Yeah, and I think the like ultra benefit of Zinchenko is that they already have a really talented left back in Kieran Tierney, but he just constantly seems injured. So like Zinchenko doing a like decade and a half younger version of James Milner of I'm going to play in central midfield, but when needed, I can also fill left back.
Yeah,
I think exactly, I think really helps them a lot. There's obviously a situation developing that may or may not relate to that club that apparently we like super can't talk about. Checked with a couple people, was surprised that it's as tight as it is about whether or not you're allowed to discuss the thing, but that could obviously massively derail things because it seemed like that was the goal in terms of the midfield pairing. But in theory, on the pitch stuff, I think Arsenal have a real chance to pip, like you said, a Chelsea team that are in transition. I don't really believe in this United squad. It's very similar to last year. And coming into last year, people thought the United squad was too talented to miss out on the top four. Obviously, they did. But yeah, I think I'm going City, Liverpool, Tottenham, and Arsenal for my top four. Unmentionable things pending. It kind of sounds like we're stuck with the same kind of group of three, because like you said, I think these are all going to be pretty close for that fourth spot. But who do you think are going to finish in those European places? And you can include UECL, and also if you think the FA Cup winner is already going to be from one of those clubs we've already mentioned.
I think like trying to pick a winner of a cup is impossible, isn't it? Because it so much of it is down to who performs on the day, which teams take it seriously, like who's injured on the day. So I think it'd be foolish to try and pick a team for that, but why the hell not? Spurs are going to win the FA Cup.
Love it. Yes, please.
I do think Conte will go hard for cups, because he'll see that as his chance to really make the statement that Spurs can be contenders and make that sort of bridging step towards being Premier League contenders maybe in a year or two. So it wouldn't surprise me if Spurs went hard for certainly one of the domestic cups. I think you're right about Manchester United. I think It's strange that they've got this new manager that seems to have made a couple of smart signings. Christian Eriksen seems like an incredibly smart signing, considering how dumb United have been in the transfer market in recent years. To go and get Christian Eriksen on a free, someone who immediately improves that team and is just a real humble guy who's going to work really hard, having gone through everything that he's gone through, obviously. He's just going to be desperate to make that work. So I think it's a very smart signing, but there's just too many question marks over the rest of the team. Defensively, it still looks like they're going to have problems putting together a back four and goalkeeper that really works together as a unit. Defensive midfield still seems like a massive issue. They've done exactly the same as they did in the first summer under David Moyes, where they've gone after a player at Barcelona who has absolutely no interest in moving. And it's just incredibly naive to see one of the biggest football clubs in the world just embarrass themselves like this. I mean, obviously they've been tipped the wink from Barcelona that De Jong is available, but De Jong doesn't want to go. So there's only so much you can do to try and make that happen when the player's not interested. It just feels like the same as the Fabregas saga years and years ago for me. So obviously that could all change. They could make me look very silly and still get De Jong. But it just seems like they've wasted the summer going after a top target that's not interested. And obviously they've got the Ronaldo saga as well, that just seems like it's going to be a huge distraction, massive problem for Erik ten Hag there. So I think top four is a stretch for them, but I think they will probably limp into Europa League again, which they'd probably prefer actually to just not qualify for Europe at all and then be able to have a proper go at it next year. I think teams like United just don't want to be in this sort of middle ground. And I think maybe Newcastle can push. They don't seem to have done the sort of splashy transfer business that people were maybe expecting or left hand were hoping for, with obviously the Saudi takeover, which in itself is extremely problematic. But the fact is, it's been allowed to happen. They seem to be being sensible rather than silly in the transfer market. They haven't done anything like Man City signing Robinho, where they got all their money and they were just like, we need a shiny, expensive Brazilian who's not going to work. They just seem to have bought players for sensible money who improve their team, which is annoying because it's not what anyone wants to see from that Newcastle project, let's be honest. Obviously, we know Nick Pope very well at Burnley. He's going to be an upgrade in goal. And Eddie Howe as well from Burnley as well. So it's essentially Burnley old boys there. But I think they are building something which is going to be difficult for the rest of the Premier League to fight against in time. I think they've got a good chance of sneaking up to sort of maybe seventh and push for that Europa Conference League spot as well. So I would go for the traditional big six because I think the gap to the rest is still too big. And maybe Newcastle are the ones to do a West Ham and sort of push on for that seventh place this time.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Yeah, very easy segue because you just name checked the club that I think could do a West Ham, which is Checks Notes West Ham. obviously, David Moyes has done a really good job since going back to West Ham. And I'm obviously there are a lot of strikers coming to the Premier League, a lot of exciting players up front in the league already. But them getting Scamacca seems to really be flowing under the radar, considering his kind of being tagged as just another Abramovich regen. I don't think he's that good, nor will he ever be that good. But I can see stylistically why some people are making the comparison. And he just seems to fit West Ham so well, where they already have really good crossers of the ball. They already have talent through the middle. They can't really rely on Mikel Antonio for long stretches as their only, you know, center forward. So I think that signing was absolutely terrific. You add that to what they already had last season. For the money that was being asked, I think they probably made the right choice and not just trying to go back to the Lingard well, especially after the season you just got out of Jared Bowen. No need to really mess with that success. So I think they're just going to be around that area for a while. And if Chelsea's transition or if United's drama or if Arsenal are dealing with legal stuff, I wouldn't be shocked if West Ham jumped into break up that big six, which they threatened to do last year and obviously the year before as well. So I think they're in for a really exciting season. And if we're cheating and when we're saying, you know, let's say Spurs win one of the cup competition. Wait, it isn't one of. I think it has to be the FA Cup. Then I also have Palace as like kind of my sneaky dark horse side. I agree that Newcastle's also a decent one. But Palace just... they seem to have hit like every note perfectly ever since letting go like the vast majority of their starting 11, not this summer, but the previous. And depending on whether or not some of their younger talents like Edouard or Elise or I forget the player's name that they just signed.
Essay.
They do have Essay as well. Yep, Zaha seems to be really locked into that project now. Obviously, having been a childhood fan of who is now his manager. Which is always fun. The defense is strong. They kind of, you know, they're young. Obviously, Joachim Anderson and Mark Gahey, and Spurs are apparently sniffing around the ladder, but I'd be shocked if they let him go. Obviously, have a really interesting goalkeeper battle probably going to shape up. It sounds like Aito wants to leave after this season. So is he going to hold the spot, or is he going to immediately lose it to an incoming player. But all in all, I think if everything goes right, I think Palace could easily finish in the top eight. So I just figured I'd mention them a little bit here.
Yeah, I think just on Palace before we move on, I think they're obviously going to really miss Conor Gallagher. I think that's something that's it's going to be really hard for them to get around. And the flip side with West Ham is that they've kept all their good players. Jarrod Bowen was linked with some clubs early in the window. Declan Rice, it's been incredibly quiet considering in his position. He's the best in the league. There's no better defensive midfielder in the Premier League now than Declan Rice for me. And he's still at West Ham. So it is tricky for teams when you're in Europe and then trying to qualify for Europe again. It does get hard, but West Ham coped with it last season, so I think they've got every chance of doing it again. And actually, I'm a huge fan of Declan Rice. I think he's an absolutely incredible player. What we haven't really touched on, though, is obviously the World Cup being in the middle of the season. We've got absolutely no idea what impact this is going to have. It could be that teams are flying and then they have 2 months off and then they're terrible. There's going to be players come back from the World Cup who have heartbreak and they might have that hangover like Salah in the second half of last season where he had the missing out on the World Cup and losing in the African Nations final, and his form just fell off a cliff for the second half of the season. So there's all these sort of intangibles that we just don't know. It's going to be one of the more interesting Premier League seasons as a result.
Yep, totally agree. All right, now let's talk about the clubs that things might not go so well for at the bottom of the table. Who do you think you'll be trading spots with at the bottom of the table?
Well, the great thing about being relegated, Kev, is we can't be the favourites to be relegated this season. We've already done it. So, yeah, I think the promoted teams are obviously going to find it tough. I think it is getting harder and harder. And we're seeing teams like Norwich, who seem to come up and go down. And Watford are in danger of doing the same. We came back and went straight back up the last time. So I think it is it's difficult to go up and stay up. Bournemouth don't seem to have done anything in the transfer market, which is one way of doing it. And Forest seem to have done a Fulham of a few years ago, spending a huge amount of money on players who haven't really played in the Premier League, which is always very, very risky. And Fulham haven't done a Fulham and haven't really bought anyone yet, really. So I think it's really difficult to see beyond those three. I think they're understandably the favourites in terms of betting. You obviously look at the teams that struggled last season. I think it's going to be really difficult for Brentford. The impact that Eriksen had there the second half of last season, obviously got a lot of press because it was Christian Eriksen coming back from the dead and all that. But Eriksen had such an impact on that team. And now he's gone. It's not just that he was their best player by a distance. It's the impacts of having someone come in who's so much better and elevated them. Everyone got to play with Christian Eriksen, and that sort of galvanised them over the second half of the season. And I just remember the games I saw at Turf Moor last season, Brentford were, on the day, comfortably the worst team. We beat them 3-0, I think. And considering how bad we were last season, if you're losing to Burnley 3-0, you've got problems. They've obviously signed Ben Mee from us on a free transfer, which might help stiffen up the defence a bit. And I really like Thomas Frank. I think he's super smart, really plugged in guy who's going to have a huge career as a manager, just maybe not at Brentford long term. So I can see them struggling. And I think Southampton are going to be down there as well. They seem to have really changed their transfer strategy this season. They've spent quite a lot of money for Southampton. I think they're on sort of 50 million, 60 million, but not really on players that are household names. They seem to have gone for really young, inexperienced players, which might work brilliantly. They might turn out to be fantastic, or they might just be not good enough yet. So I think the fact that they have changed things puts more pressure on the manager. Finished 15th 2 years in a row. It's gone a bit stagnant there. I don't know. I think I don't see a lot of goals in that Southampton team either. And as we've seen in the last few seasons, they have a tendency to get beaten really, really heavily. They seem to have one of these terrible defeats in them every season. And I just think all that could be catching up on a squad that's not going to have a lot of know-how around it this season.
Yeah, I kind of said that in my season review for Southampton that we do with Dave each year, that I was really excited when Hasenhüttl came to Southampton. I thought it would go really well, but I don't think he's managed a single-digit finish since coming. And this seems to be what the strategy is. Is just give him young, talented players, have him try to develop them, but not many of them are like at their prime or even near it. I could very much see that going wrong. I can totally see what you're saying. I also don't think Jesse Marsh at Leeds is going to particularly work out. We spoke with John McKenzie a little bit. I don't think either of us would be shocked if he left mid-season and then suddenly was available to take the U.S. men's national team job after the World Cup.
Really?
And if you think that's going to happen, then that probably means they're going to be in significant trouble. If Bamford is fit all year, maybe he can pull a 2 years ago and just kind of fire them to safety. But losing Rafinha isn't
good.
The
two guys that have lost, it's going to be huge.
Yeah.
So difficult.
Totally. And it seems like Harrison might be a target for Newcastle as well. If you lose all three of those and then you're relying on Bamford's fitness up front, that could get pretty dicey pretty fast. Obviously, stylistically, aren't really going to defend much more focusedly than they did under Bielsa. So if you're conceding opportunities on Meslier, if you're, you know, conceding possession, if you're conceding, like, it could just get really rough really fast for them. So I have opted to believe Russ, who came on and told us that Fulham's staying up this year. I'm just going to believe him. If Fulham's staying up, I think it's at Leeds' expense.
The only other team to throw in there, because I thought you might talk about them, is Everton. Obviously had a really, really wild season and sort of stayed up by a combination of inspiration from Pickford and Richarlison, who's obviously gone. Goodison Park got really, really crazy at the end of the season, sort of carried them to some freakish wins, like over Chelsea, I think they beat Manchester United as well. I don't rate Lampard as a coach at all, though. It always seems before have been defensively weak, really bad on set pieces. They've signed Tarkowski and McNeil from us. But there's a saying, isn't there, if you're signing players who get relegated, are you expecting to do better than that? I think they're both good signings who will improve them. But I think the manager's a problem there. I certainly wouldn't be surprised if Everton were down the bottom and then looking for a new manager again by Christmas.
Sure. And I did see somebody say, you know, if you're going to sign Burnley players, are you not just lining up Sean Dyche for November?
Oh, yeah. I've been saying for years that Dyche would be perfect for Everton and they keep not appointing him. But now he's available. You never know.
You never know. But you're not wrong. I mean, losing Richarlison, who I think scored something like 6 goals in their last 8 games or something like that, to help keep them up. And you mentioned Pickford, who had that like incredible double save among many others. And similar thing, are you counting on Calvert-Lewin to be fit all season? Because that doesn't seem like a super sure bet.
Yep.
The defense hasn't been incredible, although I do think that is going to be a significant upgrade on the other options that they had there. But yeah, I think Everton are probably like a healthy 12 to 15. But as we were saying, like if something goes wrong, if Lampard just, I guess he doesn't have to do anything different. If he doesn't improve, they could easily be in that conversation as well. All right, now for player stuff. Who do you think will win the Golden Boot and who do you think would be player and young player?
Yeah, so I think, well, we obviously talked about the two strikers at City and Liverpool earlier in the season, and I wouldn't be surprised at all if they were up there. Obviously, Salah's record the last few seasons is almost unparalleled. But I actually think Kane this year.
Yeah, I agree.
It doesn't seem to be that many people talking about Kane. But apart from last season when he had a bit of a sulk or whatever was going on at the start of the season, and he's got this tendency to start slowly. He had the thing for years where he just didn't score in August and everyone was like, why can this guy who scores all the time just not score in August? What's going on? I think it's all set up for Kane. Now he's obviously got in Son one of the best wide forwards in the league. Kulusevski's been really good on the other side as well. Spurs seem to be developing something really special under Conte. Like I said, I don't think they're going to be contenders this year, but I think they've got potential to be third and certainly looking for cups. And I think Kane will just be back to his best and scoring bucketfuls. I think he's a lock to get probably 20 league goals and push towards 25. So it sort of depends how many he needs. But like I mentioned earlier, the World Cup's in the middle of the season. You don't know what's going to happen at the World Cup. It might be that guys like Salah, who get that time off, it's better for them to have the break. Kane might go and score 8 goals at the World Cup. England win the tournament, comes back on a high, he's just on fire. Like, it's difficult to know, but I think Kane, from maybe Salah, from Haaland, they're probably going to be up there with the top three in that sort of order.
Yeah, I agree. I do think it's Kane, and you're totally right that people are weirdly sleeping on him considering Conte's past success with strikers. I think Son's crazy goal scoring from last season will come down a little bit, although, you know, having Kane being also one of the best passing forwards in the world game always could be a threat to Kane's own golden boot hopes. If he keeps setting up Sonny like that. But the addition of Kulusevski, who is another creator in the team, and I think that's why it was always Kulusevski over Bergvine, is if it's Bergvine, it's Kane setting up opportunities for Son and Bergvine. If it's Kulusevski, it's him setting up chances for Kane and Son, which I think is obviously a huge benefit. But also, I don't know if you saw the social media stuff going on around Sonny's golden boot. And like in all of the pictures, you had Kane looking like Gollum staring at Son holding the golden boot. But yeah, I think he's going to come out firing. And he's also had an incredible preseason. I know we shouldn't like weigh too much into that, but like you said, Kane often gets off to a slow start, but he has just been banging them in from just about every angle, every distance in preseason thus far. So yeah, I think he gets out to an early start and probably just coasts on it, unless, like you say, there's either an injury or an excitement or a disappointment or something like that that interrupts stuff at the World Cup. Obviously, if you scored the most goals, you're in contention for player of the year. Do you think that will be the same player, or do you think there will be a little bit of a difference there?
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't always happen, does it? It's normally a player from the Champions who takes it. So if I want to back City to win the league, it's probably difficult to look beyond De Bruyne. I think it's been De Bruyne and Salah have been going for those individual honours for the last few years. They are probably the two outstanding talents. City will be hoping Haaland is in that sort of company as well. Like we said earlier, it just depends on how that sort of adaptation period goes. But yeah, I think if I'm going to tip City to win the league, it will probably be daft to not say De Bruyne. I think it just depends how he gets used to having a more traditional number 9 instead of the false 9. But De Bruyne and Haaland are just too good for it not to work. In terms of a young player, it's harder to pick in a way because I still think the age is too big. What is it like?
It's 26, I think.
I thought it was like 24 or something, which I still think is way too high. It should be more like 20, 21. But I'm just looking at who's eligible now, and Haaland is eligible. So I think if Haaland has any sort of season that you would expect him to, sort of 20-ish Premier League goals, he's just going to make so many headlines, it's going to be very difficult to ignore him. But one guy that you mentioned in passing earlier from Palace, who I really like, Michael Olise, I think he's... He's got the potential to really step up and help them to address the loss of Conor Gallagher. He was obviously fantastic on loan there last season. I think Palace have got a real shot at being sort of top 10, maybe pushed for that European spot, like you were saying. I think Michael Olise is a sensational talent. If he can stay fit, he's going to have a huge season.
Yeah, I think those are really good shouts. Also, worth noting, 24 did used to be right, but it is now. You have to be 21 or younger on the preceding July 1st. So,
okay, well, I like that
21 to 22.
Yeah, there was too many times when it was the same. But like, if you're good enough to be up for the main award, then you shouldn't be on the young player one as well. Like, I don't know if that's a me being weird thing, but like, when Phil Foden was like being nominated for both and stuff, it's like, well, he's played X Premier League games already. It's too many. He's still young, but he's not inexperienced. It should be more of like a... The Athletic did a really good piece, actually, towards the end of the season, said it should be Rookie of the Year. A guy in the first season, and they were putting forward guys like Mark Guehi at Palace, who'd played in the Championship, but first time in the Premier League, made an immediate impact. And I agree with that. So maybe call it Breakthrough of the Year. However, it maybe sounds a bit more Americanized. But yeah, I think having players like Foden, who were established as some of the best in the league already, up for young player, it's daft to me. And I've just said Haaland's going to win it, having come in with a reputation of being one of the best drags in the world. So I still think it could possibly be tweaked.
Yeah, but he hasn't done it in the Premier League yet, so still counts. Exactly. Totally agree with your Foden thing, though.
Farmers League, as we know, having seen Wout Weghorst caught himself around the place. I can't get into the vague horse stuff with you again.
It should have worked. I don't understand. Either I'm wrong or it didn't make any sense. So I'm leaning to the latter.
I'll just get too angry.
Smart. Well, let's stick with Burnley. Obviously, this looks very different than what we saw last year. Not just because in the championship, but obviously huge changes in the squad, huge changes to the manager. And there are few better feelings in football than getting that first win of the season the first week, because all of the like preseason anticipation feels like it's paid off. But I couldn't help but notice it. A lot of the conversation after that match was not about the fact that you won. It was about like the massive stylistic difference between Dyche and what Vincent Kompany brought in his first official match as manager. I was just curious your thoughts on both the way you played and the result.
Yeah, well, obviously, we got the entire domestic season underway on Friday night, first game of the season, because we are massive. So, quite rightly, we were the curtain raisers for all of football, if we ignore the Women's Euros that we spent 15 minutes talking about this. it was bizarre, really, because obviously, we've had nearly 10 years of Sean Dyche. We had a little period where it wasn't Sean Dyche at the end of last season, but it was still very much like Sean Dyche's squad. It was always going to be a huge change. No one really knew what to expect. There'd been a lot of talk about Kompany wants to play in this way, and people who watched the friendlies had seen us try and adapt to that, and it had been like teething problems, and we'd had some good results and some bad results. We got taken apart by Newcastle in some training ground games last weekend, and people were like, this might be a disaster. People were talking about odds on as being relegated, looking too good, and putting bets on us to go down again. And it was just relief, really, that it already works to have, I think it was 6 debutants in the team, including a 19-year-old from our own academy. So not just someone that we signed this summer in the starting lineup, and just for it to immediately start knitting together. Incredibly pleasing. You would expect some teething problems with such a different style of play, but even the few players who were left over seemed to just take to it like a duck to water. I really thought we'd see trying to play out from the back, just giving it away, and teams just running through us because people were in the wrong places, but it wasn't really anything like that at all. I think it's fair to say that Huddersfield were terrible, but people who've been watching the Championship more than I have in the last few years, like Jake, the Newcastle fan who's on the show quite regularly, he was telling me that the Championship is terrible standard, and teams like Burnley and Watford and Norwich are just going to stomp all over it. And if Huddersfield were third last season, I know they've lost a couple of players and the manager, but if they were third, it doesn't say much for the standard of that league. I don't want to say we're going to win the league by 40 points, but we're probably going to win the league by 40 points, I reckon.
Fair enough. And of course, it's going to be a new look front line for you as well. Obviously, the Chris Wood stuff in the middle of the year, and then about Vancouver. All of that to the side, though, signing Brazilians and stuff. What's going on?
Yeah, it's crazy. Like, it's almost difficult to keep up. Vitinho, the first ever Brazilian, the starters, I think that was 9. But I don't think we're done. McNeil going obviously needs to be replaced. There's talk about Maxwell Cornet still going to go. He's got this release clause that no one seems to want to pay, even though he's really good. I don't understand. Just pay the release clause. What are teams doing? I think everyone assumes Cornet's still going to go. If he doesn't, he's just going to rip up the league, but he probably will go. So I wouldn't be surprised if we ended up with sort of 12 new signings, which is crazy. Complete transformation of the playing staff. Players who've come in are almost all sort of 24 or younger. A mix of guys on loan from big clubs like Taylor Harwood-Bellis from City. Ian Mattson from Chelsea, the left-back who scored. And it all just seems to be working really well. And the guy who played out of his skin, though, was Josh Cullen, another debutant, came from Anderlecht, was with Kompany last season. People who've watched Premier League Championship football might already have seen him around. He was at West Ham at the start of his career, played a bit, didn't really break through, and went out to Belgium. He just looks an incredible talent. I wouldn't be surprised if he was already moved on at the end of this season. I don't see him being with us for that long, but he looks an absolutely fantastic player. But up front's the area where there's still probably room for improvement. I think we've been linked with a couple of attacking players. We had Ashley Barnes up front on Friday, which he was all right, but we had all these young, athletic, super energetic players making all these runs, and then Ashley Barnes up front being like doing Ashley Barnes things, you know. So it wasn't as much as the transformation and the fit seemed really good. I think it was obvious that we need a different kind of striker in that team. That's always going to be the key sign. The last two times we've been in the Championship, we've had strikers that scored 20 goals. It's not easy to just go and sign a striker who's going to get you 20 goals, otherwise everyone would do it. But I think if we went to do that, it's probably going to be hard to stop us this season.
Gotcha. And then obviously very sad. We don't need to get into what's going on with ownership and why it's happening or why it happened so late in the game. But just a moment to reminisce on Dwight McNeil's time at the club.
Yeah, I mean, it is a shame because it's going to be harder and harder when I make appearances on the podcast to shoehorn him in when he's not at my club, and my club's not even in the Premier League anymore. But yeah, it is a shame because I felt like he was the one that we could keep. Like, Pope, I think everyone understood was going to go. An England goalkeeper in a World Cup, yeah, he needs to be in the Premier League. Everyone got it. Nathan Collins, I think people got that needed to be in the Premier League. He was too good when he broke through. It was like, it was understandable. Tarkowski, we knew was going to go. Ben Mee, I think we had a feeling was going to go. So a lot of the key players that went, we were already resigned to that. I wasn't resigned to Dwight McNeil. I thought we were going to keep him. Obviously, a local lad who's come through our own academy. It's difficult to put a price on that. I think when you're trying to sell this vision to young players, to have your own attacking star who's come through the same system, I think it's almost priceless. And I think all the guys that have been sold, we haven't really got the best money for them. But like you say, it's the ownership stuff and the takeover stuff. We don't really have time to go into too much detail. But yeah, hopefully he does well at Everton. Obviously, I've said I think it's going to be difficult for them this season. I can see Lampard leaving before Christmas, so it could be another weird season for Everton. I don't think it's a great move for him, to be honest, but I think he's a super talented guy. Probably does need a change of scenery. But it is a bit upsetting to lose someone for up to 20 million, who I still think is potentially 40, 50 million pound player if he continues to develop. So hopefully that happens and we get to see him at his best in the Premier League. It's just a shame it's going to be for Everton, who I now hate.
Yeah, I saw all the stuff between some of the Everton pods and Natalie Bromley, who obviously did the Known and Never stuff with you, and I've done a couple appearances on before. And yeah, there seems to be some growing animosity between those two fan bases, and I'm sure it'll be worse when Sean Dyche inevitably takes over in late October. I was going to talk to you about Burnley Luton, but since this is a Premier League podcast, I suppose we could go the other way and talk a little bit about Spurs and Southampton. Just curious your thoughts on that one heading into the season.
Yeah, well, like you've heard over the last hour or so, I'm really high on Spurs this season. I think Conte is a fantastic coach. Smart signings seem to have worked out really well. I think Southampton signings are a bit more out there. Like, lads from big clubs who haven't played yet and paying sort of 15 million for them. Like, it's, I think it's risky. Southampton finished last season quite badly as well, and I think there's often a real hangover there. I think Spurs as well, the new stadium's going to be really important for them. We've obviously had these like two weird seasons where it's been behind closed doors and stuff, and I feel like that stadium's only just now starting to be like home. It always takes time, doesn't it? It was the same for Arsenal when they moved. It took a while until they really settled. I think West Ham, obviously London Stadium, the Olympic stuff, the athletics track, it was a really hard adaptation for them. I think it's been easier for Spurs, but I still don't think it really feels like their home. But I think Conte will go hard on making it really atmospheric. He's really one for winding the crowd up, isn't he? So I think there'll be a lot of that. It'll be always set, like, you can't see because it's a podcast, not a video, but I'm doing the Italian arm waves, which Conte will be doing. And there'll be a lot of that gene up the fans. So yeah, I think Spurs will probably get off to a winning start. I think maybe even like a statement win to really put down that message to the rest of the league that they're going to be pushing for top four, certainly, and compete for cups and stuff this season.
Yeah, I'm a little nervous considering how much we just dunked on Southampton.
Yeah, Southampton's terrible. They're rubbish. It's not going to work. All their new players are going to score hat-tricks. It's like 20-0.
Yep, and James Ward-Prowse, who we were interested in, but then ultimately chose to not sign. He's going to bang three free kicks and have two more assists from corners. But yeah, I think I would have been more bullish had the match against Roma gone better. Obviously, it's preseason, but we hadn't lost in preseason yet. So doing it in the last one just feels like a little disruptive, especially with an 11 that mostly looked like what it'll probably look like week one. I really hope Davinson Sanchez does not start as the left-sided center back as Ben Davis deals with injury. Can't believe I'm saying this, given how he's looked for the last 2 years, but I'd much prefer Clement Longley to start in that left-sided center-back role to start the season. But outside of that, it looks like how it's probably going to look. Doherty on the right, Perisic on the left, Romero, Dyer, whoever the left-sided center-back is, Højbjerg and Bentancur, Højbjerg and Bissouma, and then the front three of Kulusevski, Kane, Son. So probably not too many changes, which is always good going into a new season. Obviously, a lot of additions to add depth, a lot of additions to help with the five subs thing. Obviously, Conte didn't really trust a lot of the air quotes depth that we had last season. But yeah, I'm thinking this is probably a win at home to start the year. If it's not, I don't think anybody will panic too much, because like you said, there's so much excitement and expectation coming into the season. I think that would override one result, especially if we played well and just didn't get the points. But yeah, let's hope it starts well. And like I said, with my thinking that Kane is just raring to go to start the season, I'm going to go Kane brace to start in probably a 3-1 win. I'm going with.
Do you think you're done with transfers as well? You seem to do all the business quite early, which is good, but...
It's a great question. I think we're a centre-back short.
Fans always want to see more, don't they? And like, with a month still to go, like... I'm not his agent, and I'm not trying to push him to go, but someone like Maxwell Cornet, I think, would be a great signing for Spurs. As another sort of depth piece, someone who can play multiple positions. He'd be an option at left wing-back, cover for Son. He's like...
Totally.
He'd be really useful. And for the prize, I think the release clause is something... meant to be 17.5 million for a club like Spurs. That was pocket money, really, isn't it?
It's Jed Spence money is what it is. Yes, I would definitely, I'd definitely be interested in signing someone like Cornet. And like you said, he covers a lot of positions. I just don't know if that's what it's going to be. I wouldn't be surprised if we signed one more attacking player. I think the idea was sign an actual striker and have Richarlison as wing depth, but we could go the other way. Sign a player like Cornet and then have Richarlison be specifically striker depth. I mean, not specifically, he can still play. It's not like he suddenly is incapable of playing in other positions. But yeah, that could be the way. But I think the big one is center back. My guess is Spurs are going to take one last swing at Bastoni and Gvardiol. And then the big question is, will they bring in somebody that isn't one of their primary targets just because it's still a need? Or was the point of Longley to be able to try to sneak by another year? Like you're saying, maybe this year isn't the year that we're pushing for the title, and just say, you know what, next year when we get Bastoni, and then we're really pushing for the title. Of course, that still expects that for some reason within 1 year, Bastoni decides that he hates playing in Italy for his hometown team. Anyway, yeah, I think we'll sign one more. I think it'll either be a center back or an attacking player, but time will tell. And as I said on last week's show, we just have to either sign no more players or two more players. Cause if we sign a seventh, everybody's going to do like photoshops of the Baldini seven, and it's going to be Richarlison's face on Chadley's body. And it's just going to be dreadful. So
yeah, no one wants to see that.
Yeah, no,
that's not my that.
No, thanks. But anyway, we'll wrap the show up there. So Jamie, if you'd like to tell folks where they can find you or anything you're working on, now's a good time.
Yeah, it's good to be back on a Premier League show, even though I've talked about Premier League club anymore. So sorry if you were hoping to be rid of me this season. I guess you haven't. I write and edit the Burnley newsletter, No Name Ever, which goes out by a Substack if you're interested in following more about the Vincent Kompany revolution. It looks like it's a really interesting story this season. It's free. It goes out on a Monday by a Substack. You can get it by my Twitter as well, which is at Jamie Smith Sport, which is inevitably full of hot fire takes throughout the season as well.
Love it. And I'm your host, Kevin DeVries. You can find me on Twitter at Kevrov. You can find the show at EPL Roundtable or by searching EPL Roundtable in all of your podcast services. But yeah, Jamie, an absolute pleasure speaking with you. Best of luck to Burnley throughout the season. And folks at home, we hope you keep listening.
Thank you. Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.